Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
Hey kids, you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, and this show is Fish Out of Agua with Michelle Carlo. Today is Tuesday, October 31st, 2017, which means it's Halloween! We'll be taking our Wayback Machine back to the late 20th century East Village and Lower East Side for this episode, a time and place some of you may know and remember, and others won't know and maybe won't care. That's okay. We all have songs that remind us of where we were at that place on that night with that person, and that crazy, wonderful thing happened. And this song just happens to be one of them. For me. And we're back with Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. That was Oh Bondage Up Yours by the late, great Polystyrene and X-Ray Specs from their Germ-Free Adolescence album in 1978. And let's keep going with this song, chosen by this week's guest artist to open their episode.
It works.
And we're back with Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. That was Brooklyn band Grizzly Bear with Four Cypresses from their 2017 album Painted Ruins. And I Googled them because I really liked this song and I wanted to know more about them. And I found out that one of the band members' last name is actually Bear. That's crazy. I wonder which one of them is named Grizzly. Yeah, we're getting all freaky-deaky because it's Halloween. But anyway, now, guess what, kids? It's time for my favorite part of the show. Everybody, welcome to Fish Out of Agua's Guest Artist of the Week! Woohoo! Oh, this is, you know, you're the first guest that's done the woohoo with me.
Oh my goodness, I can't believe it.
Okay, so yeah, this is my favorite part of the show, and I am sitting here with one of my favorite humans, and yes, every week I say that the person that's with me is my favorite, but in this case, it's actually more true than true, because I know this woman since the 20th century, going back to the Art Star. Yes, we're going back to the Art Star, Surf Reality, Collective Unconscious, Alternative Comedy Performance, Lower East Side scene with writer, designer, and fellow cat human, Marie Mundaka.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hola.
And fellow New Yorker, too.
Native New Yorker.
Yeah. So we could talk about all kinds of coffee and windows and stuff.
And when we bought things.
Like I could have taken the D train.
I could have taken that too.
Yeah.
But I didn't.
Yeah. So welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Oh my God, I haven't seen you in so long. Marie and I, we've worked together on different projects over the years. She was one of the first people to review what my performances and my writing, because she's worked for many publications, which we will get into in a little bit. And, you know, sometimes you just need to find an excuse to hang out. So here we are. Yay!
In beautiful downtown Burbank.
Beautiful downtown Burbank, looking at the water.
Yes. And all the hot, hunky surfers.
All the hot, hunky surfers. Oh, yeah.
I don't even know if Burbank is on the water.
No.
Probably not.
Probably not. So as you can see, us New York girls are geographically challenged. So Marie, how did we meet? I know that it was back in the 20th century. I'm going to guess it was the mid to late 90s. And
yes,
but I don't remember if it was at the open mic, at Face Boys open mic, if it was at Rev Jen's Anti Slam. But you had said in the pre-show, because we do a little pre-show, that you had a story. So I'm really interested to hear what that is.
Some people think that we met either at Face Boys or Rev Jen's.
Some people. That would be me. The some people, or that would be just other people.
Probably other people too. Okay. But we actually met at a Dance Revolution thing.
Oh, the Dance Liberation Front?
Liberation Front. You guys were having a little demo in Washington Square Park. And you and Bex Schwartz were frugging with Norman Siegel.
Really?
Attorney, activist,
I know.
Norman
yes,
Siegel.
I actually have photographs. And I was not looking like Michelle. I think
no.
I was my alter ego.
You were your alter ego.
Carmen Mofongo, the Lower East Side's one and only Latin lady with staff on her head. I have a photograph of me dancing with Norman Siegel in Times Square. Yeah.
Yeah, you guys were buds back then.
Yeah, he went to a lot of DLF events.
He did.
Okay,
yeah.
So for people who don't know what we're talking about, the DLF, or Dance Liberation Front, was a kind of activist performance group thing that was founded by the people from Surf Reality and Collective Unconscious, Robert Pritchard, Faceboy, and Reverend Jen. And this was in opposition and direct response to the archaic cabaret laws from the Giuliani mayor administration. So we're talking Giuliani was the mayor of New York. This is like the 90s, people. And with these laws, correct me if I'm wrong, Marie, but it was you couldn't dance in a bar. That was illegal, correct?
That's correct. The cabaret laws are actually from the early 20th century.
Yes.
And had not been enforced since the 50s. When Giuliani came into office in the 90s, he decided it was like Footloose all of a sudden. No more dancing.
That's right. And Footloose, people were still thinking about Footloose because it had only come out like about 8 or 9 years before.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was kind of weird. You and I grew up in an era where you could go to a club, a bar even, and dance. And all of a sudden we were not allowed. People were getting ticketed for rhythmically moving their asses.
Yes, rhythmically moving. I remember that. And those cabaret laws also had their roots in total racism.
Yes.
Because they basically were targeting the many jazz and blues clubs that were up in Harlem.
Exactly.
And God forbid the fancy little white girls should dance with a black man or a brown man. They might have brown babies.
They might get ideas.
Yeah, they might get ideas. Well, you know what dancing leads to.
Yes.
Yeah. Fun.
Sex. Fun.
Yeah. So, yes, so the DLF, we protested against this law, and we would do these dance-a-thons or dance events in many different places. Wow. So Washington Square Park, huh?
Yeah, I was there with Peter Bernard. We were filming for Rules Like Ozzy, and he was friends with Bex Schwartz and also with Reverend Jen. So I think it was Bex who told us, hey, come down to this thing and film. There's going to be a lot of fun people down there. You'll get some good interviews. So we did.
Wow. So tell us, Rules Like Ozzy, tell us about that.
Rules Like Ozzy was a public access TV show, which is what we used to do back in the old days before the YouTubes. We would actually put on...
In the early years of the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We would put on television shows, basically. Okay. Manhattan Neighborhood Network. It was on, I don't remember if it was Channel 16 or Channel 17.
No, it was like 20 years ago. Who cares?
Yeah.
No, I care. You know what I mean? I don't mean I don't care, but you know what I mean.
But
Who remembers?
It wasn't
Who remembers?
On Channel 35, which was the Robin Bird
That was
channel.
Right. Oh, my God. How funny. So, okay. So, Rules Like Ozzy.
Yeah. So, you know, I lived in Manhattan since I was a teenager, and I basically have wanted to do a public access show since I started seeing things like TV Party and, of course, the Uncle Floyd show, which
wasn't public
access, but it was a low-budget television
show. It was about as public access as an actual television show could be,
because
it was on UHF as opposed to VHF.
Right.
Ooh, explain that, Marie.
I don't know if I can explain it, but it was, you know, these were...
The higher number channels.
Pre-cable TV channels that were higher numbers, super local specialized TV channels. Channel 68, where Uncle Floyd was, came out of northern New Jersey, and you could only get it in parts of Manhattan, the Bronx, and New Jersey. I don't even know if you could get it in Brooklyn unless maybe you had a really big antenna show. So I wanted to do a show like that, and my friend Peter also was very interested in doing public access, so he came up with the idea of doing a TV show. And Rules Like Ozzy was basically a magazine-style show about anything that we thought ruled like Ozzy ruled. Like, if you rule like Ozzy, you are awesome. Yeah, so if you were doing something we thought was awesome, we wanted to have you on the show. And sometimes that was people who were maybe a little bit famous. And sometimes, like, I think we had Mudhoney on once.
Oh, cool.
That was, I think, the most famous we got. Oh, we had some Warped Tour people on, so they were a little famous. Actually, I said Mudhoney was the most famous people we had on, but it's not true. It was the Upright Citizens Brigade.
Oh, wow.
And
they went to the open mic. They went to Face Boys open mic.
When they first came to New York, they made a concerted effort to bring the different communities together and sort of infiltrate and befriend, and it was so much fun. Amy Poehler used to call, well, there was a Rules Like Ozzy hotline number, because all the best public access TV shows had a hotline number, which was just a voicemail. And, you know, we'd leave a goofy message or a song, and people would leave goofy messages. So Amy Poehler used to call us rapping Wu-Tang Clan lyrics.
Oh, that's so cool. Oh my God, do you still have any of those?
I think it's all lost, unfortunately.
Oh, too bad. It would be great to like start putting all that stuff on YouTube or something.
I know, it would be great.
Yeah. I mean, this is, we're talking here like the mid to late 1990s where
it was probably 97.
Yeah. So they were still the last vestiges of what people considered the heyday of the East Village and the Lower East Side. And there were many publications, out print publications, that covered the scene, one of them being the East Village Eye.
Right.
And the other one you wrote for, which whose name escapes me
the
right
waste.
Now. The Waste, that's right, the New York Waste. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
The Waste was a punk rock publication. It was kind of like a more artsy version of The Shadow. The Shadow was the anarchist publication, and but The Waste was just cartoons, comics, and music, basically. Very little else, but it was on a regular schedule. So I don't know where the money came from, but they had like a 2 or 3 color cover every month, and it was on newsprint, and it was oversized and multiple pages. And I used to write a entertainment column just about fun stuff I did that month. And other people we knew also drew comics. I had a lot of talented comics artists and cartoonists back then.
There's a lot of, it's always a lot of talent around. I think that in the era that I'm going to say that we came up in as artists and performers, we were just surrounded by talent, like inundated by talent, like overflowing talent, like talent up the wazoo.
Seriously.
And we really came up with some really interesting people and did a ton of interesting stuff. But where did it all start with you, Marie? I mean, you are from Staten Island originally, right?
Staten Island.
Oh my God.
The Shaolin, as it's known.
The Shaolin.
To the fans of the Wu-Tang Clan.
And you lived there until you were, in your late teens, early 20s?
I lived there until I was 18.
Okay.
Then I left. As soon as I graduated high school, I was out.
One thing that I've always loved about Marie is that, like, people would say to me that they would think that I was cool, and I would be, nah. Because Marie, going to, like, CBGBs when she was, like, 14 and 15, and she would get into clubs that I would get thrown out of because I was not as cool as Marie.
I don't know how I did it. It's funny because
do you think it's your Latin lover looks?
It might be, because there's this new...
Because she's Chilean, you know.
I am. There's this new... book coming out about the Mud Club. It's written by one of the doormen from the Mud Club.
I actually got in there once.
And that's the thing. I used to go to the Mud Club all the time, and I never thought anything of it. I'd be like, what are you doing tonight? Are we going to the Mud? All right, let's go to the Mud. Go there, walk in.
Go to the Mud. I love it.
And now I find out subsequently, apparently, it was hard to get into. And I'm like... Really?
Maybe the fact that when I was like 18 or 19 or 17 or whatever, I looked like I was like 8, 9, or 10.
That's the thing. That could have hurt. Much older.
Yeah, no. I stole the clubs you went to so I could like bask in your excellence so I could live vicariously through you.
First it was CB's and Max's. Yeah.
You went to Max's Kansas City?
I used to go to Max's all the time.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, my God. Tell. Spill. Who'd you bang in the bathroom?
Nobody. Nobody. The place was disgusting. I did have sex in the bathroom at CB's.
Oh, that wasn't disgusting.
It was much worse than Max's. I just did it because it was a thing.
Mm.
It's like everyone had to do it. It was the rite of passage.
So wait, so Max's closed in what year?
I'm not sure. You 78?
Must, oh, Jesus. You must... you were 7.
I was 7 years old.
So, wow. So did you see, like, the Dolls? Who did you... Did you see anybody? I mean, did you, like, just go there to hang out? Like, what bands?
I already didn't like the Dolls by that point.
Okay.
Now, first of all, Dave Johansson's from Staten Island.
Yes.
So that's, like, negative cool points
as far as
I'm concerned.
If you're listening, Buster.
Yeah. But I did not see The Damned. I wanted to see The Damned, but it was too crowded to get in. Saw the Dead Boys a bunch of times.
Oh, the Dead Boys.
Saw the Dead Boys.
Cheetah.
Saw Cheetah's.
Cheetah's still alive.
Saw Cheetah's.
And his hair is still red. I saw a picture of him.
Good for Cheetah.
Good for him.
So I used to go to Max's. I never saw famous people hanging out there, but I was always kind of oblivious, and I was also drunk.
Yeah.
So
But that's a native New Yorker thing, to be oblivious.
Right.
Like, I pass by people all the time that other people have told me, did you see this? Did you see this? I'm like, no, like, no, whatever. No. Well, you know, one time I literally bumped into Andy Warhol. Literally.
I almost did several times in the farmer's market.
And Richard Hell came in and spoke to my class and fell asleep in a chair.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah.
Was that at SVA?
Yeah. Yeah, I think he was really good friends with the English instructor, who I wish I remember her name. She was like the best teacher I've ever had.
That makes sense that he'd be friends with her, because of course he's a poet.
Yes, he's a literary dude.
He is.
Yes, as well as a nihilist and a solipsist.
Literary genius.
Yes. So tell us about some more exploits from your well-spent youth.
Well, I remember one time my friend went to Max's and he came back super excited. He said, I just sat at a table with Robert Fripp, and I was like,
King Crimson!
Yes.
Oh my God!
Holy fucking shit. You sat at a table with Robert Fripp, and he was like, and he was super weird, and he kept doing Monty Python skits, and I was like, what the hell?
Robert Fripp was doing Monty Python skits?
Like, this is like the confluence of all my interests right here. Max's Kansas City, prog rock, and Monty Python.
Oh, my God.
But I wasn't there that night. So
two girls that like King Crimson.
Yeah.
Check this out. Some girls do like the prog rock
a little bit.
Yeah, it's right. I love King Crimson, though.
Yeah, they were great.
Yeah, they were great.
So I missed that. But at CB's, I saw Blondie. Blondie did like a residency of 7 nights. Every night was sold out. It was bananas.
Oh, geez. What year was this?
It was when Plastic Letters came out. So I'm not sure what year that was. Were there 79? No, it couldn't have been because I was with Jim.
John Mush?
No.
I would have believed it if you would have said yes.
That would have been cool. But no, it was someone much slimier.
Was it the one that wore cleats?
Yes.
So say that story.
It was 78.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was 15. I was auditioning to be in a band at this guy. So, Jim lived in his mother's basement, literally, and he had recently inherited $2,000. So with that money, he bought a van that didn't work. He spent $800 on a van and $1,200 on pot. And the pot was terrible.
$1,200 on weed?
Yeah, that he had planned to sell, but it was homegrown in a time when homegrown meant shit.
Right, so not like today.
You couldn't get high off it. It was terrible, terrible pot. And so he had this van that barely ran and pot he couldn't sell.
Oh my God, so he's a real winner.
He was a real winner, but I was like, hey, he seems to be into me and I want to go out with a guy who can buy me beer. Oh, one time he met me at the bus stop and he was wearing a denim jumpsuit.
What?
And I was like, and you know, and I'm there with like my heavy, heavy black eyeliner and my super red lips. And I'm wearing like my black peg leg jeans and he's in a denim jumpsuit. And I'm like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing. It was January. Somehow we'd managed to continue dating. This was the end of our relationship, though, at this point. We had continued dating from, like, August through the holidays. He was also a compulsive shoplifter. So he shoplifted a lot of things for me for Christmas, which was very kind
of him. Loves Baby Soft?
Yes, loves Baby Soft. So we're going to CB's. It's snowing. And it was a very cold winter already, and the streets were icy. At this point, I believed him to be 28 years old, and I was 15.
Oh.
However, he was not 28, he was 32.
Oh.
I don't know why he thought taking 4 years off his age would have made a difference, but he told me he was 28 when he was 32.
That's illegal.
Yes, whether he was 28 or 32,
yes.
It was illegal.
Yeah.
Yeah. I show up at the ferry terminal and he is wearing his winter boots, which, you know, bad enough. He's not wearing Chuck Taylors and
right.
He has cleats on them. I don't notice the cleats until he gets up and we're walking. The ferry comes, the door opens, we're walking towards the door and it's like, I hear this click, 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 click. And I'm like, what the hell is on your feet? And he's like, I got cleats. It's icy out. I don't want to slip. And I'm like, definitely so uncool.
Oh my God.
And I don't know if we were going to see the shirts that night or if it was one of the nights where we went to one of the only nights when CBGB's theater was open. CBGB's theater was a very short-lived experiment at late 77, early 78. It was like right around Christmas to right after New Year's. And after that, it was closed. I think it was at the old location of the Fillmore East. So it's this theater, basically, and there are seats and everything, giant stage, and they had, the night that I went, they had Talking Heads. I went to see Tough Darts and Milk and Cookies, that's all I wanted to see, but Talking Heads was the big band.
Oh.
On another night, Patti Smith played.
Wow.
I didn't see that one, but they were shut down by the fire department, and so he's wearing cleats, and I was horribly embarrassed, and I left without him that night.
Ah, good for you, making your choices at the age of 15. Right. It's important for young ladies to know what they will and will not stand for. An inappropriate, doofy dress cannot be.
Yeah.
No.
No.
So here's a question. How do you think all of these myriad experiences of your well-spent youth influenced you in your writing later on?
Well, I write a lot about that time because it seems like it was the last time in our culture when teenagers were allowed to sort of run rampant and do what they wanted to do. You didn't see that past 1980. It was over. Basically, it was Eaton Pates. It was when Eaton Pates got kidnapped.
Oh, my God. Eaton Pates, for people who might not know, because we do have listeners that are not from the United States.
They weren't even born then.
Yeah, right. But we also have listeners that are not from the U.S. Eaton Pates was, he is the reason why they put missing children on milk cartons. He was a young boy, 6 years old, who was living in Soho. His parents were artists. And this was like when Soho was really Soho, not a shopping mall. Actual artists lived there. And on the day that he's allowed to walk to the bus stop, on the friggin' corner, so like 50 feet, he disappears and is never to be seen again.
It was so horrible.
Yeah, it was really horrible. And today, they're still trying to figure out who killed him.
Right, they still...
Nobody. Never found a body.
This was a time when...
That poor family, that poor child.
Yeah, it was horrible. Gay men used to cruise the piers.
Yes, the dilapidated piers.
The dilapidated piers.
And how many people do you think they took one wrong step, fell through, and were never seen again?
Probably a lot.
Yeah.
Especially people were high then.
Yeah,
people were high all the time.
Yeah.
People were high. People were ugly. People were ugly back then. That was a time when people were allowed
this
to be
ugly. This is true.
Ugly.
And they were allowed to suck. I'm not talking about sucking appendages. I mean, like, you could be bad at something.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter. Like,
right.
You could be a bad musician or a bad poet or a bad artist or a bad comedian. And that was almost like a badge of pride to suck at something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a lot more freedom back then.
Yeah.
And this was kind of like the last time in our culture when we had that freedom. And I think you and I were lucky enough to have been able to experience that.
Yes, we caught the tail end of that.
Yeah.
We did. Oh my God. So how did that influence your writing though?
Well, I write a lot about that time. It's something I look back on with, you know, with wonder and horror that, you know, I was doing these things that were completely inappropriate. When people say, you know, oh, they're teenagers, the teenage brain isn't really formed until it's 21. It's really, really true. I made a lot of bad decisions.
Yeah, well, who didn't, you know? But we lived.
Yeah, we lived. We all made a lot of bad decisions, and we all lived.
Sometimes I think that when people look back on history, they're going to think that people that lived through the 70s and 80s, they like or grew up then, came of age in those two decades, like how the hell do we live?
Yeah.
We should all be dead.
We should all be dead.
Because no cell phones. Nobody knew where we were.
I know.
No. It's just like you left the house at 10 o'clock in the morning and it's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are? Hell no, because they're in CBGB's with a 32-year-old guy. Oh, my God.
I know.
Wearing cleats. So when we get to the 90s and we're all performing at Surf Reality, you were continuing to write criticism and cover different events for which publications? New York Waste and something else. I can't remember.
Extreme TV.
Yes.
Which was a website / public access show that my friend did. And all through the 80s, I was doing zines. That was sort of my thing.
Oh, speak a little bit about zine culture. Zine because zines are like the best.
Yeah, I was zine girl back then. So I always wanted to do like fan club newsletters. That was my thing. When I was a kid, I like joined every fan club, Banana Splits, Monkees, everything. And so, you know, you'd get this, you'd send in a dollar or a quarter and a box top, and you'd get something back in the mail, like a sticker and always a newsletter saying, you know, oh, did you know Davey likes to have walnuts with his oatmeal in the morning or something stupid, you know?
Something mundane.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to do with my life. I want to do these these fan club newsletters. So when the early 80s happened, I started doing different fanzines. At that point, though, fanzines were, it was kind of limited because we didn't have computers.
Right. But you barely had word processors back then. Like IBM Selectric.
We had the Selectric. Oh, God. And we had the Wang.
Oh, my God. I remember the Wang.
There was a word processor called the Wang. All it could do was process words. It could do nothing else. Right. But it was a word processor that could store information. So
how did we live through all that?
I don't know. Fanzines were super limited back then. I used to write for some when I was in high school, and people would mimeograph.
I mean, we were lucky we had staplers.
I can't believe, I can't believe we lived either. So in the 80s, this is when PCs started to happen, and graphical user interfaces, and suddenly there was this thing called PageMaker, which was the first program where you could actually lay out a page on a computer screen.
The precursor to Quark and then InDesign.
Yes.
Yeah. And in fact, like the cave painting version of it.
In fact, little known factoid, InDesign is PageMaker.
Really?
Adobe bought Aldus, which was the owner of PageMaker, and they basically took the PageMaker interface and upgraded it with some of the stuff that Quark did and made it into InDesign.
Well, if you use InDesign at your day job, now you know where it came from.
Yeah. So PageMaker existed. I got a bootleg copy of PageMaker, and I started doing fanzines, music fanzines. It was always music. And I do stupid ones, like I did one for my boyfriend's sister's friends about Duran Duran, and then I do fun ones that I'd give out at clubs, and it was just a lot of fun.
One of the things I always admire about you is that you always keep up with new music. I mean, most people, they end up being stuck in what they listen to before they were 30, but you keep up with music now. Marie's music selections, which you will be hearing before, you will have heard already, and you'll be hearing after, are like from now. It's not like I will do stuff from like 80s, 90s, early 2000s, but like you just keep current. And what do you attribute that?
Boredom. There is so little that in music that I connect with that I kind of feel like I have to keep up, just hoping that there's like more people for me to listen to. Like, I think my two favorite bands from when I was a teenager were Wire and Buzzcocks.
Mm.
And there have been a lot of people who've like continued on that Buzzcocks tradition of punk pop, power pop, but I didn't think
falling in love with someone you shouldn't have fallen in love with.
But I don't, no one's really done it as well as they have. But Wire, no one's ever really done anything like them since then. So I've sort of been on a search since then for more music that's in that vein of Wire, which is kind of creepy, atmospheric, sometimes goes off into dance territory, sometimes goes off into noise territory. And that brings you eventually to things like, you know, early 2000s TV on the Radio.
Yes.
And Radiohead, and now you have Grizzly Bear.
Yes. I know Grizzly Bear.
Yeah.
I'm not a rockosaurus.
That's
I know
right.
who Grizzly
you
Bear
know
is.
You know the Grizzly Bear.
So after we passed through that whole Surf Reality Collective Unconscious thing, which ended in the early aughts, I like to say aughts on the air, I discovered storytelling, and one of the things that I did was I put together a storytelling show called It Came From New York. And I did this in 2005, and my idea was, because as a performer, And you know this, as like as someone who's a fellow native New Yorker, you'd often be in a room with other performers, musicians, writers, whatever, and you'd be the only New York native. Because like everybody else came here from someplace else. Mm-hmm. But so I started this show called It Came From New York, and you were one of the first people that I had in the original little crew, because I wanted to have someone from the Bronx, Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. And you had so many amazing stories. I mean, one of them, when you said that boyfriend, we keep going back to him. Is he still alive? Oh my God, is he gonna find us? Oh my God. When you said that but we probably will anyway.
We can make fun of a 32-year-old man who was dating a 15-year-old, though.
That's true. And like 30 years later, he'd be a 65-year-old. And I'm not even going there. So. Anyway, you said that he had a van, and I was wondering, like, one of the first stories that you told with me on It Came From New York was how you sold a car to go see Gigi Allen.
I did.
And I don't know if that's the story you're going to tell for us now, but right now, Marie Mandak is going to tell one of her It Came From New York stories.
I'll tell a shorter version of that story.
Yes, tell a short version.
So, it's the early 90s, and you know, even though I lived through punk, and it seems like the 80s was a wasteland, so for me, when I think back on my fond times of my youth, it's really the early 90s and the grunge era more than anything. And I was living in the East Village, and I had a car because I had previously been living in Jersey City, and you could have a car in Jersey City, and I did have one, but then I moved to the East Village, the car stayed on Staten Island. Because I was impulsive and impetuous, I decided on a whim to quit my job. I had no money, but I did have money in a 401k. So I cashed out my 401k, and I was like, I'm just going to live on this and hang out every fucking night until this money runs out. And I'll live frugally, and I'll eat scrambled eggs and mint peppers every day like I did when I was a kid, and it's going to be great. And it was great. Because Monday night was my night off, but Tuesday I'd be commuting at Limelight, and Wednesday there was something, and Thursday where there was something, and Friday was Stigmata at the Pyramid, and Saturday was Ward 6 at the bank, and like there was something to do every night at the Batcave. There was something to do every night of the week. It was great, and I'd had time to see all my friends' bands, and I didn't feel bad about going because I could get up the next day any fucking time I wanted to. And I would get up at 10, and I'd walk to the gym, and I'd take a class, and I'd walk home, and I'd dream of fucking Genie for a couple of hours, and it was glorious. But then the money started to run out. I coasted on the money for quite a long time, but the money started to run out, and I was like, ugh, I really don't want to go back to work. It was like, the summer wasn't over yet. I was like, can I possibly stretch this out anyway? And I'm like looking at all my finances. I'm like, my clothes are ratty. I can't sell them. I don't want to sell my records because I love my music. And back then, what could you do with your records? You could put them on a cassette tape. You couldn't burn them to your computer. So I didn't know what to do. And then I remembered, oh shit, I've got this car at my parents' house that I could sell. And I was like, nah, I'm not at that point yet. But my friend Andy called me up, and he's like, oh, hey, Marie, Gigi's playing. And I'm like, oh, Gigi's playing. And he says to me, yeah, but it's $10. And I'm like, $10? $10 was a lot for a show back then. It was like, you know, $7 was like the max you would pay for a show on that level. I mean, we're talking a Gigi Allen here. We're not talking Billy Joel. So it was $10, and I was like, oh, I can't afford $10. And Andy's like, you got to get the money, Marie. Andy wasn't even going to like pony up the money for me. He was just like, you got to get the money. So I was like, oh, we'll see what happens. Okay. So Gigi Allen, he was this sort of East Village ghost spirit. He was the spirit of the East Village. He was the monster of the East Village. He was this horrible creature who like took the punk ethos and like did everything that your parents thought were happening at punk shows, and he actually did them. He would cut his forehead and bleed like he was in WWE wrestling. He would literally shit on the stage. He would urinate in people's mouths. He was often completely naked, except for his motorcycle boots for some reason. At various points, he would have a beard and a mustache and long hair, and sometimes everything would be shaved. He had ugly ass tattoos that clearly looked like they came from prison. It was horrible. So, and his music was quite shitty. It was all very terrible. They could all play their instruments, but the songs were really nothing. They were stupid, stupid songs about shit and titty fucking and like really dumb stuff, complete juvenilia. And but you know, it's Gigi Allen, and you sort of feel like, well, you have to go see this, because how can you call yourself a punk if you haven't seen Gigi? So Andy's like, you gotta go, you gotta get the money, Marie, because we gotta see Gigi. And I'm like, okay. So I'm like, I got the car, I'll sell the car. So I say to my dad, Dad, I'm selling the car, okay? And I'm gonna put out an ad in the Staten Island Advance. But you know, I don't live on Staten Island, so you guys are gonna have to take care of it. And my father says to me, and I'm gonna say something super racist here that my father said. He said, fine, but don't sell it to any Chinese women. And I was like, Dad, I'm selling it to whoever I want to. Whoever wants to give me money for this car is getting the car. My father is, he's kind of, he drives like a taxi driver. And he's not a native New Yorker. He was born in Chile. I don't know where he got this crazy taxi driving ability, but like, he's very attuned to the road, and like he sees his possibilities of where he can go like 10 cars in advance. And for whatever reason, whenever we're driving in Chinatown, some lady cuts him off. And he's always like, Chinese drivers, oh, not just Chinese drivers, Chinese ladies, they can't drive. I mean, we all know the ladies can't drive to begin with. He's Chilean. This is acceptable from them. So he says, all right, you can, anyone but a Chinese lady. So of course, the first person that shows up is this lovely Asian gentleman who's buying the car for his wife. And I let them buy the car. So I get my however many, it's thousands of dollars I get. This is gonna keep me going for another couple of months, which was great. And I buy my ticket to the Gigi Allen show, and Andy and I go down to the bank that night, and there's a sign on the door that says, Gigi is sick. We will refund all tickets. I'm like, fuck. So I somehow get, you know, a couple of weeks later, I do get the money back. A couple of weeks later, I get wind of this show going on at Beowulf, which was a club on Avenue A. Gigi's playing at Beowulf. They must have posted flyers or something, because it certainly wouldn't have been in The Voice. So it was $7. It was super cheap. So I was like, oh, great, I'm going. They weren't selling advance tickets. So I was like, I'm going. Andy couldn't go because it was a weeknight. Wamp. So I went all by myself, a little waif, a little 28-year-old waif, going to Beowulf, and, you know, I wore my grunge clothes, my cut-off shorts, and my flannel, and I go up to the front because I'm like, I'm paying for this, so I have to see this. And I go up to the front of the stage, and there's a lot of people at the front of the stage before the show begins. And then the band comes out, and they start playing before Gigi comes out, and then Gigi comes out, and immediately the pants come off. He comes out in clothes, but the pants come off immediately. And a guy goes up to him and begins to fellate him. It was horrible. He was not turgid in any way, and nor was he turgid when the guy stopped. The guy just like sucked on it for a little while, and then it was over. Gigi like punched him in the head to indicate that he was done. And all the while, like, he's singing some stupid song. And the show gets more and more raucous. There's like mosh pits. At some point, a woman goes to take a photograph, and Gigi kicks her camera and breaks the camera, of course, because that's what Gigi's going to do. And she starts yelling, I'm going to sue you, I'm going to sue you. And maybe she did, but what is she going to get from Gigi? He's got no money. So the show's getting more and more raucous. There's urine, there's blood. When he starts defecating on the stage, that's when everybody backs away. Because at this point, they're like, oh, shit's literally getting real at this point. So people start backing away, but Gigi's like totally into it. So at one point, he jumps up and he jumps into the audience, but everyone is in the process of moving away. So he jumps into the audience and he lands on his back on the floor in a pile of his own urine. And I'm looking at him, I'm like, I sold my car for this? And that's my Gigi story.
Oh, my God. I think I might have seen a video of that. I've been actually one of one of the people that I interviewed a couple of weeks ago. We also spoke about Gigi Allen. Gigi Allen was a big influence in his life. So I was watching some of the videos and I was like, oh, my God. Anyway, Marie, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you
for being on Fish Out of Agua. So where, if people want to keep up with your fabulousness and your chronicling of like our well-spent youth, where can they find you? Instagram, Twitter, Facebook?
I am nowhere right now. You can find me on Instagram occasionally at Mungo181.
Mungo181.
Mungo, M-U-N-G-O, 181. Mungo is Mungo, and 181 is a street I used to live on, and you can find me there. Or you can look for Kitty Kind.
Kitty Kind, that's right, because we're cat humans.
Yeah, I do Instagram for Kitty Kind. You can tell my Instagram by the bad spellings of things, because I'm usually typing while I'm walking and it's like, oh, whatever that word is.
Yeah, still doing the DIY.
Yes.
Live and die by the DIY.
Exactly.
And Marie, in closing, if you had one little, not, I don't even want to say piece of advice, if you had one thing that you would tell that child in living in the little bedroom in Staten Island or any little small town where they feel like they need to get out to be who they are and what people are telling them they can't be for whatever reason, what would you tell them?
Get the fuck out. You can do it. You can do it. Make it happen.
You can do it. Make it happen. All right. Fish Out of Agua and Marie signing out.
Bye.
That was Townie, preceded by some hissing cats. Townie is by another fellow Brooklynite, Mitski Miyawaki, from her 2014 Bury Me at Makeout Creek album. And guess what, kids? That's our show. You have been listening to Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. And we have an announcement. Usually we talk about Patreon and sponsoring shows, which of course you can do. Just go to the RadioFreeBrooklyn.com homepage, click on the donate tab and follow the instructions. And we would be so grateful if you would sponsor not just our show, but any of the fine shows here on Radio Free Brooklyn. Radio Free Brooklyn is also partnering with the Footlight Bar in Ridgewick or Bushwood, depending on what you think of it. It's near the L train, the DeKalb stop on the L train. And we've been, Radio Free Brooklyn has been doing monthly shows. And guess what? Fish Out of Agua gets one. There is going to be a Fish Out of Agua storytelling show featuring five people who have been guest artists on Fish Out of Agua with Michelle Carlo during season two. David Hugh, Alana Lancaster, Gaston Almonte, Susan Kent, and Sydney Washington telling stories. And there's going to be trivia, prizes, maybe some surprises. It's going to be a fun night. So why don't you guys come out? This is going to be, I'm going to be promoting this every week for the next month, so get used to it. Ha ha. It's going to be on Monday, November 20th at 7 p.m. at the Footlight Bar, 465 Seneca Avenue in lovely Ridgewick or Bushwood, New York, Queens, New York, or Brooklyn, New York, depending on what you think. Take the L train to DeKalb, and admission is only $5. $5 for all these stories and all this entertainment. It's well worth it. You're going to have a lot of fun. Believe me. Yeah, it's going to be great. Well, kids, we opened this week's show with a Back in the Day song. And we're going to close with one. This is Wire, Outdoor Miner from the 1978 album Chairs Missing. Happy Halloween. Stay tuned to For Brooklyn Bandstand next, and we'll see you next week. Woohoo!
No blind spots in the leopard's eyes can only help to jeopardize the lives of lambs the shepherd cries. A love's a life for a silver fish, eternal dust. The clean room, a house gets away. He lies on his side as he tries to hide the fact it's the earth, which is nonsense, but he lies on his side as he tries to hide the fact it's the earth, which is nonsense, but face worker. Thank you.
which is nonsense.